Franklin Roosevelt. The young man who ran laughing from the waves off Campobello Island that day in 1921 was a man who seemed to have everything. He was handsome, athletic, and wealthy. He'd started a promising political career and had already served as a state senator and assistant secretary of the Navy, and his family name was one of the most prestigious in America, Roosevelt. It was warm that August day in Campobello, and Franklin Roosevelt had been indulging in his favorite pastime, sailing. From childhood, he had a passion for anything that had to do with boats or the sea. This day, he fell from his boat into the ocean, and although this was unusual, he cheerfully climbed aboard again. The rest of the day, he felt chilled, but he thought little of it. When Roosevelt arose the next morning, he felt uncommonly tired. He sought his usual remedy, a brisk swim in the waters of the Atlantic. When he was done, he ran across the shore and back to the family home. There he picked up a stack of newspapers to read and settled in at his desk. He wrote later, "I sat reading for a while, too tired to even dress. My left leg lagged. Presently it refused to work, and then the other." By the third day after his swim, Roosevelt couldn't even stand or move his legs and was suffering from severe pain. Soon his back, arms, and legs became partially paralyzed, and he could no longer hold a pen. He said, "While the doctors were unanimous in telling me that the attack was very mild, I had, of course, the usual dark suspicion that they were just saying nice things to make me feel good." He was right. Franklin Roosevelt, at the age of 39, had been stricken with polio. Word spread quickly through the Democratic Party to which he belonged. Franklin Roosevelt's political career was over. Roosevelt was an invalid. What his friends and the politicians hadn't reckoned on was that Roosevelt was not a man to give up. Only a few years before he had said, "There is nothing I love so much as a good fight." And perhaps his hardest and greatest fight of all was his fight against polio. His own mother urged him to retire, but instead, Roosevelt launched a campaign of exercise, swimming, and therapy that helped him regain the use of his arms, hands, and back. Then he tried to learn to walk again. He used gymnasium equipment, and he swam daily, saying, "The water put me where I am, and the water has to bring me back." As he practiced walking, he had several bad falls, but he kept on trying. He also spent several months at a spa in Warm Springs, Georgia, because many polio victims had been helped by the warm mineral waters there. Only Roosevelt's legs refused to respond to therapy, surgery, and his own fierce will. Although they improved a little, for the rest of his life, he couldn't walk without the use of braces, crutches, or a cane. During his fight with polio, Roosevelt was confined to bed for 2 years, and during those 2 years, Franklin Roosevelt was transformed. Far from breaking him, suffering lifted him to a new stature. He utterly conquered personal fear. He gained new depth and compassion. As a friend of Roosevelt said, his thoughts expanded, his horizons widened. He thought of others who were afflicted and in want. Lying there, he grew bigger day by day. One of the first things Roosevelt did was to buy the spa at Warm Springs and the land around it, so he could expand and make it more accessible to people. When he saw how many patients could barely afford the cost of polio treatments, he began a foundation to help them, a foundation that years later financed Jonas Salk in his discovery of a polio vaccine. Roosevelt emerged from his sickbed a cripple, but his spirit was stronger and healthier than ever before. The searing fires of adversity had forged a public servant. They had taken one of society's overprivileged and reduced him to helplessness. But when he rose again, he rose as a man dedicated to good works. Physical pain and suffering had helped to shape a new president of the United States, a president who would soon revolutionize the office and his country. Until he emerged from the ocean that day in 1921, Roosevelt had known almost nothing of suffering and adversity. He was born January 30, 1882, the only son of James Roosevelt II and his wife, Sarah Delano. His birthplace was the family mansion at Hyde Park, New York. Nowhere on either side of the family tree was there anything but wealth and prominence. His mother, Sarah, was one of the strongest influences on Franklin. She was a beautiful and class-conscious woman who liked to remind Franklin that, thanks to her, he could trace his lineage to 7 passengers on the Mayflower. She passed on her sense of confidence and entitlement to her child, and she also dominated him and tried to control his life. His mother gave him a rigid schedule for his daily activities, including when he should eat, study, and play. Even after he was a grown man with children of his own, she would order him to put his boots on before going out in the rain. As a boy, Franklin was raised in luxury. He had his own boat for sailing and his own pony. He visited Europe 10 times before he was even 15 years old, was tutored privately at home, and was waited on by the family's numerous servants. Besides boating, his favorite hobbies were stamp and bird collecting, which he was allowed to pursue to his heart's content. He was given everything a child could want, except perhaps freedom. He was not an unhappy child, but he was private and seldom confided his innermost thoughts. Until he was 14, Franklin Roosevelt spent barely more than a few hours away from his mother and father. Then he was sent away to the prestigious boarding school, Groton, to prepare for college. Coming from the sheltered background he did, Roosevelt had a hard time at Groton. He seldom mingled with the other boys, and in classes did just enough work to get by. Mostly he played tennis, read sea stories, and wrote to his mother, whom he deeply missed. There was only one sign in his years at Groton that Franklin Roosevelt was destined for leadership. When he failed to qualify for the baseball team, he organized a new one and led it to victory against the other. There was something else that emerged at Groton, too. Roosevelt began to develop political opinions. These opinions, which were not at all what one would expect from the child of aristocrats, made him a name as a nonconformist and a dissident. He became interested in blacks and Jews, and in the struggle of the Boers against the British in South Africa, he took the unpopular side of the Boers. Roosevelt was so passionate about the sea that, when he was 16, he came up with a plan to run away and enlist in the Navy. When that plan had to be abandoned because of a case of measles, he decided instead to enroll at Annapolis after graduating from Groton. It was a plan that didn't stand a chance. Long ago, his parents had decided he would attend Harvard, just as all the Roosevelts before him had. Roosevelt started at Harvard in 1900, as a new century was beginning. When he was still a freshman, his father died, and his mother now pinned all her hopes and ambitions on her only son. Those hopes were simple and typically aristocratic. Like his father, Franklin would spend most of his time running the family estate and would perhaps serve on a few boards of directors and might serve as the head of a local hospital committee. Sarah Roosevelt was in for a few surprises. At college, Franklin was far more extroverted and involved than he'd been at Groton. He served on a rowing team, edited the college newspaper, and was a cheerleader for the football team. But mostly he was known on campus for the fact that he shared the same last name as the new president of the United States. Theodore Roosevelt, his 5th cousin, had risen to the office when William McKinley was assassinated. The success of his cousin had a profound influence on Roosevelt. It was in these years that he began to consider the idea of following in his cousin's footsteps. Perhaps because of that ambition, Roosevelt began to court Theodore's favorite niece and his own distant cousin, Eleanor Roosevelt. He had known Eleanor since childhood and had always admired her interest in serious issues and her high ideals. Like Franklin, Eleanor Roosevelt was born of America's elite, but she never felt elite. She attended all the right schools, but she never developed the right interests, like partying and debutante balls. She was more of a shy wallflower than a coquettish belle. People found her homely, including her own pretty mother, who dubbed her with the nickname Granny. Her father loved her, but he was an alcoholic and died young. Eleanor never seemed to fit in the class of society to which she'd been born. Roosevelt's mother was strongly opposed to his interest in Eleanor. It's possible she would have opposed his serious interest in any woman. She even took Franklin on a Caribbean cruise in hopes he'd forget Eleanor, a plan that failed. Although the two became engaged in his senior year, At his mother's insistence, the marriage was delayed until Roosevelt was past 23 and the bride was 21. The engagement of Eleanor and Franklin Roosevelt was considered incredible. He was handsome and playful. She was plain and insecure. A volunteer inspector of women's lavatories and garment factories. But later it would be Eleanor who nursed Franklin through his polio and helped instill him with courage and optimism. And it would be Eleanor who became one of the most dynamic and admired first ladies in history, a great leader in her own right. When they married in 1923, President Theodore Roosevelt came up from Washington to give his niece and godchild away. At the time, Franklin was studying law at Columbia University. The newlyweds settled into Hyde Park, where their first two children were born. It would be a few years before Eleanor could have her own house and get out from the watchful eye of Franklin's mother. Even then, Sarah Roosevelt bought and decorated the house herself, which disappointed Eleanor deeply. She kept quiet, as she did throughout her marriage, rather than cause tension with her mother-in-law. After he passed the bar, Roosevelt joined a New York City law firm. But all the while, he was making plans for entry into the political arena. The opportunity came in 1910, when the Tammany Hall scandal broke, and the Democratic Party needed respectable names to regain its standing. Roosevelt was nominated to run for the state Senate in New York, a battle no one expected him to win. But he amazed them with his vigor and determination. He put the enemy on the defensive with strong, fiery speeches. He took to the back roads of the state in his old red Maxwell sedan, becoming the first candidate to campaign by car in New York. To almost everyone's surprise, he won. As a state senator, Roosevelt argued for the then unpopular idea of women's suffrage and supported progressive Woodrow Wilson at the Democratic National Convention. He was rewarded when Wilson was elected and handed Roosevelt the post of Assistant Secretary of the Navy. He loved his new job. Now he could combine his favorite hobby, the sea and ships, with his official work. He said, "I now find my vocation combined with my avocation in a delightful way." The First World War gave Roosevelt plenty of opportunity to exercise his skill and expertise in matters of the sea. His use of submarine chasers helped defeat the fearsome German subs, and he himself went on secret missions in a destroyer to various naval stations. He gained a reputation as a man who gets things done. When the war ended, he'd made enough of a name for himself to be nominated as his party's vice presidential candidate at the Democratic National Convention. He campaigned hard, making over 800 speeches, but the Democrats lost to the Republicans Harding and Coolidge. Roosevelt had won something else, however, the attention of the nation. His tall, handsome, and urbane ways captured their imagination, and his powerful speeches made a lasting impression. He was 38 by now, and although most people liked him, he was seen almost as a dilettante, a charming but superficial man without serious opinion or intention, who felt he deserved a high office simply because of who he was. That was all soon to change. It was the next year that Roosevelt took his swim off Campobello, went to bed, and found he couldn't get up again. Throughout his four-year battle with polio, he refused to allow any pity from either himself or others. "No sob stuff," he told his family. By the time he was 42, he was able to make a dramatic appearance at the National Convention, rising from his chair and approaching the podium, slowly and painfully, on crutches, to give a nomination speech. When he reached it, he gave a triumphant smile, and the entire audience rose to its feet to applaud him. Those who had said Franklin Roosevelt's political days were over began to reconsider. Now a hero, a man known for his bravery and his ability to conquer obstacles, Roosevelt ran for the governorship of New York and won. By now the Roosevelts had five children, whom they affectionately called the Chicks: Anna Eleanor, James, Elliot, Franklin Delano Jr., and John. A sixth child died in infancy. Roosevelt was a devoted and playful father who liked to swim, sail, and go sledding with his children. Even when they were all grown, the clan would gather together at Christmas, including grandchildren, to listen to Roosevelt read A Christmas Story. Roosevelt was known for his friendly smile, his flashing eyes, and his warm voice. He had two famous trademarks: the glasses he wore clipped to the bridge of his nose, and the cigarette holder that jutted upward at an angle from his mouth. Although he was slender as a young man, after his bout with polio, he became stocky. As governor of New York, Roosevelt introduced many progressive programs, including the development of water power, civil service reform, and social welfare measures such as old age pensions and modernization of prisons. When he was re-elected for governor 4 years later, his campaign manager commented, "I do not see how Mr. Roosevelt can escape becoming the next presidential nominee of his party." He couldn't, and he didn't want to. He was nominated in 1932 in the middle of the country's worst economic slump in history. Roosevelt was the first president who, instead of telegraphing his acceptance, flew to the convention and made an acceptance speech in person. His campaign song was "Happy Days Are Here Again," and Americans liked it. They were anxious for someone new, someone confident and smiling and full of hope, like Franklin Roosevelt was. He won, hands down. With Roosevelt's election came a profound shift in power and a transformation of our government. Because of the two men who traded office in 1932, perhaps no two men were more different. At the beginning of that year, the man who still sat in the Oval Office was Herbert Hoover, a Quaker who personified the Protestant work ethic, who strongly opposed government aid to the poor and unemployed, a man with rigid and moralistic ideas who responded to a veterans' bond march on Washington by sending in Generals MacArthur and Patton to fire on the crowds. The son of a blacksmith and a former mining engineer, it was Herbert Hoover's fate to be the president everyone blamed for the Depression. Perhaps no man left his esteemed office in more disgrace, with the possible exception of Richard Nixon. The newspapers that the destitute huddled in for warmth were called Hoover blankets. Broken-down cars being towed off the streets were called Hoover wagons. An empty pocket turned inside out was called a Hoover flag. And the shanty towns that housed the homeless were called Hoovervilles. Eisenhower liked to tell the story of how a little boy once approached Hoover for an autograph. The president happily obliged him, but as he was writing his name, the boy asked him if he could have a second autograph as well. "Why?" asked Hoover. "Because," explained the boy, "it takes two of yours in trade to get one of Babe Ruth's." Campaigning, Roosevelt pledged himself to helping the average American, whom he called the forgotten man. He promised a new deal for the American people, saying, "Let us all here assembled constitute ourselves prophets of a new order of competence and courage. This is more than a political campaign. It is a call to arms." Americans heeded the call. Roosevelt defeated Hoover in a Democratic landslide. He carried every state but six. He won 472 electoral votes to Hoover's 59. It was the greatest Democratic victory in over 80 years. And ahead was one of the greatest challenges any president, Democrat or Republican, had ever faced. When Roosevelt took office, 15 million Americans were unemployed, 25% of the workforce. Many got their daily meals in public bread lines. Banks all over the country had closed their doors. Personal savings, homes, and farms had been lost. And thousands of businesses had been shut down. In his first inaugural address, Roosevelt told the American people, "We need not shrink from honestly facing conditions. This great nation will endure as it has endured, will revive and will prosper. The only thing we have to fear is fear itself, nameless, unreasonable, unjustified terror which paralyzes needed efforts to convert retreat into advance." Roosevelt put the government to work creating jobs for the unemployed and relief for the poor and hungry. He stimulated the economy and made vast social reforms. In many countries, like Russia and Germany, totalitarianism was on the rise in 1932. But in America, government committed itself to helping its people. During his so-called 100 days, in the first 3 months of his term, Roosevelt rushed through Congress a flood of programs aimed at reviving the economy by a vast expenditure of public funds. He imposed excess profit and dividend taxes, cut government salaries, and got Congress to gain control of the banks, devalue the dollar, withdraw all the gold in the country, and go off the gold standard. He implemented government work projects where the jobless were put to work building roads and dams and government buildings. He formed a brain trust by calling to Washington economists, scientists, writers, and professors to advise him on possible solutions. He put together a dynamic cabinet that included the first woman ever named to a cabinet post, Frances Perkins, Secretary of Labor. Within 3 months, Roosevelt and his team had put together astounding New Deal experiments, including the Conservation Corps, the Farm Relief Act, the Tennessee Valley Authority, the Homeowners Loan Association, and the Federal Relief Act. It was Roosevelt who introduced both unemployment insurance and Social Security. Many of his programs became known by their initials, the TVA, the CCC, or the NRA. And soon, Roosevelt himself was known by the affectionate nickname FDR. The acts and programs of his first term curbed the powers of Wall Street, gave jobs to millions, made it easy to get home mortgages, abolished child labor, controlled prices, brought sanitation, electricity, and flood control to areas that needed it, and brought new rights to workers in collective bargaining. In all these efforts at reform, First Lady Eleanor played a key role. It was she who showed up at breadlines, pouring soup, who dropped in on WPA projects, who lunched with railway porters, who read to kids in the Dust Bowl, and who tended the sick in the slums. A famous New Yorker cartoon of the time said it all. Deep in a mine, a soot-covered worker with a lantern on his head stops his coal shoveling and says to another miner, "For gosh sakes, here comes Mrs. Roosevelt." 1932 was the beginning of 40 years of public service that would forever endear Mrs. Roosevelt to the people of America and the world. During those years, she spoke often on human rights and the goal of world peace. Later, she would serve 16 years as the United States representative to the UN. She had once said, "None of us has lived up to the teachings of Christ." But somehow, this remarkable woman, who was convinced she had no beauty at all, got the idea that the elevation of the human condition was more than an afternoon-a-week affair. It was a reason for being. After Eleanor, the role of the First Lady was never the same. Throughout the Depression, Franklin Roosevelt also used the medium of radio to its full advantage. His fireside chats, in which he encouraged and reassured his fellow citizens, became famous. 50 million Americans at a time tuned into the chats, which always started with the words, "My friends," and always finished on a note of optimism and action. He was so popular with the American people that when he was elected for a second term, it was an even bigger victory than his first. He won 532 of the 532 electoral votes and lost only two states. In his inaugural address, he said, "I should like to have it said of my first administration that in it the forces of selfishness and lust for power met their match. I should like to have it said of my second administration that these forces met their master." There was still much to do, and he was determined to see it through. In spite of his astounding popularity at the polls, Roosevelt was also making many enemies. Many of his programs threatened the special privileges of the rich American elite, who began to call him a traitor to his own class. Some called him a fascist. Others called him a communist. The slogan, "Tax the Rich," was bound to make him unpopular in the old familiar circles in which he'd been born and bred. Some hated him so much they refused to use his name, referring instead to "that man in the White House" or "that cripple in the White House." But Roosevelt stuck with his programs of reform, never compromising, even though he made more enemies with each bill and program. There were others, not just the wealthy, who opposed Roosevelt because they felt he was giving the government too much power. He ran into particular problems when he tried to get Congress to give him the power to increase the Supreme Court from 9 to 15, so he could put his own appointees on it. It was his way of fighting back when the court declared many of his New Deal programs unconstitutional. But the idea was opposed even by Democrats. Republicans began to organize a revolt against Roosevelt, managing to defeat more and more of his bills, including his attempts to establish new cabinet posts, such as a Department of Public Welfare. But the masses, who strongly approved of most of his New Deal ideas, continued to support him. By the end of his second term, there were two problems bothering many Americans. One was the threat of another world war, and the other was the question of whether Franklin Roosevelt would run for a third term. He did, and he used the first problem, the threat of war, to defend his decision. When Roosevelt accepted the nomination of the Democratic Party in 1940, at the age of 58, he broke the national tradition set by George Washington at the very beginning of the Republic. Washington refused to run for a third term, for fear it would make him appear a dictator. Roosevelt, unbothered by that fear, felt that the crisis brewing in Europe required him to extend his service to the state. The American people, too, seemed to want him as their commander-in-chief. They made him the first president ever to be elected to a third term of office. Roosevelt went right to work, preparing for the worst. He began a military conscription, the first president to do so in peacetime. He set up naval bases for defense. And he made sure that industry began turning out more guns, tanks, and other equipment to make what he called an arsenal of democracy. He ordered seizure of all German and Italian vessels in American ports, and at a secret meeting with Winston Churchill, drew up an Atlantic Charter designed to destroy Nazism and set up a post-war world where freedom reigned supreme. In spite of all this, the United States continued to remain neutral on the war until, on December 7, 1941, neutrality became impossible. When the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor, Roosevelt called it a date which will live in infamy. And then, like Churchill in England, he began to rally the American people towards victory. The next years were years of immense work and pressure. Roosevelt made plans for a British and American invasion of North Africa and worked closely with Churchill to set up one of the most successful military alliances in all of history. He also helped set up the United Nations and then met with both Churchill and Stalin to plan the most important step of the war, the Allied invasion of the west coast of Europe. In 1944, Roosevelt, then 62 years old, broke all precedent again by running for a fourth term as president. The Republicans fought hard and ruthlessly, but the public, particularly in the middle of a world war, chose to keep faith in their leader. He won again by a wide margin. By now, the hard work of the Depression and war years were beginning to take their toll. Roosevelt's hair had turned white, and he looked far older than his years. His face was thin and gray, and his expression was often grim. He was worrying not just about the outcome of the war, but of the uneasy peace that might follow it. This last worry brought him to Yalta for a conference with Churchill and Stalin, a conference that has ever after remained a source of controversy. There are many who think Roosevelt sacrificed too much in his effort to assure peace, especially to the Soviets, who then launched their own campaign of conquest in the years after the war. Some think Roosevelt should have seen it coming. Others say he could never have known it. Roosevelt returned from Yalta, reported on the conference to Congress, and left for a vacation in Warm Springs, Georgia, the spa where he recovered from his polio. A few weeks later, while having his portrait painted, he complained of a severe headache. 3 hours later, he had a stroke. It was 5:47 in the afternoon on April 12, 1945, that Americans heard on their radios the shocking news that Franklin Delano Roosevelt had died. For 13 years, he had been their leader, and for 13 years, they had loved him. The day of his funeral, men, women, and children across America cried openly in public. Only a month later, Germany surrendered, and the war in Europe was over. 3 months after that, Japan surrendered. Franklin Roosevelt had missed the end of the war and the return of peace by only 4 months. For all the years since he died, Roosevelt has remained as controversial as he was in life. He's been called the worst president in history. He's been called the best. He was both idolized and despised, viewed by some as a dedicated reformer, by others as a power-hungry tyrant. Like Julius Caesar 2,000 years before him, he was a crusader for the people, who some felt would sacrifice anything, even the Constitution, to achieve his goals. He was accused of giving the federal government too much power at cost to the state governments. He was criticized, and still is, for the fact that during his office, the national debt rose higher than ever before. His own class, the upper class, saw him as a traitor. Yet he may instead have saved them, for the wealthy class cannot exist without the consumer, and when Franklin Roosevelt took office, there were millions of people who couldn't afford to consume anything. One thing is certain about Franklin Roosevelt. He made changes, many changes. Faced with the collapse of the capitalist system, he pioneered the idea of government intervention, in which the economy was consciously managed to achieve certain desirable ends. Under Roosevelt, the government became an active instrument of social transformation. He also made the Democratic Party the majority party through his appeal to the working class and minority groups. It continued to be a vehicle for liberal reform as he had created it through the 20th century. Perhaps most notable of all, Roosevelt was born an aristocrat with all the privileges the American upper class has to offer, and yet he dedicated his life to the common people. He reached out in a way he never had to, at a time when most of his class were fighting only to protect their own interests. In doing so, he risked much. Yet this man, this crippled man, led America through its worst depression and its worst war. The people loved him for it. He had his critics, but Americans made him the first president to win a third and then a fourth term. In the end, as always in America, the people had the last word.
This is the end of the session.